Having already looked at a general and rather superficial way at some of the individuals involved in the rise of the pseudoscience of eugenics, we'll now have the opportunity to look a little more closely at some of the important features of these same individuals, beginning with Abbot Gregor Mendel, often referred to as the father of modern genetics. Abbot Mendel, as we've described, did experiments with garden peas, noting 7 specific characteristics in these peas and then interbreeding them in a way that allowed him to determine how the characteristics were inherited. Among the things that he described as a result of his research were the designations of certain characteristics as dominant or recessive, describing how they are inherited in subsequent generations and whether they need to be present in the parent organisms. His interpretations and his data were rather well known in certain circles in the middle and toward the end of the 19th century, but they did not receive widespread attention for a variety of reasons, and one of them, which I've described as rather ironic, is the fact that he did very careful statistical mathematical analysis of his data, and this was not well understood by the science of his day. It really wouldn't be until the 20th century that statistics would become a required subject for any prospective scientist, and even in the area of medicine, to determine whether or not particular practices or proposed cures were truly being effective. Gregor Mendel was indeed, in many ways, ahead of his time. But in the 20th century, his findings were rediscovered, and his description of mechanisms of inheritance was applied to other observations that had already been made and had become very widespread and indeed somewhat controversial. And if we now drop down to number 1.2, Darwin's findings were among the most significant and widely known because of the controversy that they evoked. Controversy, of course, concerning his idea of the origin of species, not that he was in any sense the first to describe evolution or the idea that there had been different forms of life on Earth long before human recorded history. The sciences of paleontology and of archaeology had been going on for quite a long time, and it was well known that there were many creatures that had existed on the planet which had subsequently become extinct. But the mechanism by which organisms changed, the nature of this change, was very much in dispute. Darwin's contribution was to describe and make normative the idea of the process of natural selection. He posited that there are a wide variety of characteristics that occur in nature, and that some are selected for by their capacity, their ability to provide a unique advantage in survival, so that in given areas, the characteristics that enable survival to take place will necessarily be transmitted to subsequent generations because the organisms that possess them will reproduce in the greatest numbers. This notion of natural selection had a number of philosophical consequences. One of these was the notion that it is the hardiest that survive. And this is precisely the point that Darwin is commenting on in the passage that I've cited and which we've looked at before. The query as to whether or not the science of medicine is actually doing good or doing harm to the human species. By enabling people to survive to reproductive age and even to reproduce in significant numbers who would not otherwise be able to do this, is medicine actually in some sense making human culture less well adapted than it otherwise would be? Darwin raises this question, but doesn't really provide any kind of a program for improvement in the race for the simple reason that he is horrified at the prospect that one would stop employing what he calls the emotion of sympathy. We must, he says, bear the undoubtedly bad effects of the weak surviving and propagating their kind. So Darwin is himself in no sense a practitioner of or recommender of eugenics in the sense that it comes to be described as a science of improvement, of deliberate improvement in the race, based on the fallacious notion that human beings actually know what is good for the human race, what characteristics we really ought to be selecting for. And as we'll see, Darwin really has put his finger on the fundamental problem of eugenics, not only the issue of what would indeed be the best characteristics to select for, but the problem of compulsion. Because if eugenics is to succeed, it would necessarily need to be practiced throughout the entire human race, and that would mean that there would have to be some coercive agency that could enforce certain kinds of marriages and forbid certain others. And as we'll see, it was his cousin, Francis Galton, who commented on this specifically. As we've mentioned before, and if we drop down now to number 1.3, Galton was a very gifted scientist, and his contributions to the area of genetics are still regarded as groundbreaking and important and fundamental studies. But what we find in Galton is someone who, unlike his cousin Darwin, is more than willing to acknowledge that if eugenics, and he is the one who coins this term, the idea of human beings making choices about which characteristics should be encouraged and which characteristics should then be transmitted to subsequent generations by enforcing certain kinds of marriages or making them socially encouraged while forbidding or preventing others. Galton, and this is something that some of his supporters dispute, it is clear that Galton was aware that coercion would be necessary, and we find this in the text that I've quoted, the text that begins, "The subject of race improvement or eugenics," he says, "I cannot doubt that our democracy will ultimately refuse consent to that liberty of propagating children which is now allowed to the undesirable classes." And here we're reminded that in Galton we have someone who is not only interested in the elimination of what are clearly diseases in the human population, he is also concerned with what he regards as the desirable or undesirable characteristics of class. And there is really no doubt, if you read Galton's writings, that for him it was the characteristics of the middle and upper middle classes in England that were to be made normative for the rest of the world, and which she says here could be enforced by refusing to consent to liberty, which is another way of saying by employing ultimately coercive means to create these selective choices within the population. Galton, as we have already mentioned, was the real founder of eugenics, and indeed was one of the founders of the Eugenics Society, and many of the early advocates of family planning and contraception were also ardent promoters of eugenics, which they believed would be a proper way of understanding why making contraception available in a very widespread and broad way would not only, to use the language of the of many early feminists, provide women with greater control or greater liberty, but would also have the secondary, as they regarded it, desirable effect of encouraging breeds of individuals who ought not to be reproducing to not do this. So there often was a eugenic mentality and a eugenic motive behind many of the early practitioners of family planning, both in England and in the United States. If we move down to number 1.4, it's with Friedrich Nietzsche that we discover an attempt to provide a philosophical basis for eugenics. Eugenics was now claiming that it had legitimacy both based on the observations of Darwin and now with the rediscovery of the genetic basis of inheritance in the writings of Abbot Gregor Mendel. Was now claiming to be based in good science. With Nietzsche, to a certain extent, it now claimed a certain philosophical panache. And here, too, those who are fond of Nietzsche's philosophy are embarrassed by and often deny that Nietzsche wrote anything that could properly be used by those supporting eugenics, but I think that's very difficult to deny. One central characteristic of Nietzsche's philosophy was his idea of the Übermensch, the overman or the superman, that it would be possible for human beings to evolve in a certain sense, and he was primarily concerned with an intellectual, an emotional, a spiritual evolution that would take them beyond bourgeois morality and bourgeois ideas, even of thought. And this is well expressed in his tone poem, Also sprach Zarathustra, which he completed in 1885, and I've quoted several texts here. Behold, I teach you the Superman, the Übermensch, the Overman. He is that sea in which you may drown your great contempt. This idea of Verachtung, or contempt for what one has been, a kind of a deep-seated, repugnant repentance of one's bourgeois mentality. What is the greatest thing you can experience? It is the hour of great contempt, in which your happiness, too, becomes disgusting to you, and also your reason and your virtue. Nietzsche is concerned with the overcoming of what he regards as the constraints of ordinary morality and definitions of virtue. The hour when you say, "What is good? What good is my happiness? It is poverty and filth and wretched self-complacency. But my happiness should justify existence." What is the greatest hour? The hour when you say, "What good is my reason?" And then in the last little section, and the hour when you say, "What good is my virtue? As yet, it has not inspired me to razon, to passionate rage. How weary I am of my good and my evil! All that is poverty, filth, and wretched self-complacency." Nietzsche believes that there is this interior experience of both contempt and a rising up into rage that will transform the individual into levels of potentiality that had not previously been even thought of. But it's not merely an interior transformation that Nietzsche proposes. In his book, Der Wille zur Macht, The Will to Power, he makes it clear that he believes that there should be social encouragement to, and even social constraint to, the development of certain other aspects of this Übermensch, of the new kind of human being that ought to be brought into being. And in Book 3 of The Will to Power, his Principles of a New Evaluation, or a completely laying aside of previous values and a rediscovery of new ones, he says, on the future of marriage, he recommends, and if you drop down to the second point here, advantages of all kinds for fathers who bring many boys into the world. And then, rather curiously, a medical certificate preceding every marriage endorsed by the communal authorities. Definite questions must be answered by the couple and by doctors, and clearly the questions he's interested in are those that would be of interest to those who promote eugenics, defining whether or not certain limitations or characteristics or so-called diseases, and reminding ourselves that we're in an era that predates a very clear and consistent diagnosis of things like mental disease. This would be important in Nietzsche's vision for the future of everyone who would marry. But even more explicit is number 734, if you drop down a little further. He says that for the love of humanity, there are cases in which a child would be a crime, as in the case of those who are chronically ill and neurasthenics of the third degree, people who are very weak and don't seem to contribute much to society. So he's not talking simply about clear congenital illness, very, very serious incompatibility with life. He's talking about chronic illness that people should not be allowed to reproduce. So what are his methods? Well, he says in a very cynical and sarcastic way, well, you might try to encourage them to chastity, perhaps with the aid of Parsifal music. And then he goes on to be sarcastic about the notion of control of one's sexual impulse. He says, the priest and moral philosopher are playing a losing game. It would be better to send the person off to a drugstore, presumably to find something that would help them control their sexual desire. But he concludes here, in the end, society has a duty. Few more pressing and fundamental demands can be made upon it. Society is responsible to life for every unsuitable, verfehlte life. It also has to atone. Thus, it ought to prevent them. So Nietzsche is clearly describing the necessity for constraint, for a coercive element in society that will prevent certain kinds of births and encourage others. Society ought to prevent procreation in numerous cases. It should be prepared without regard for heritage, status, or spirit to employ the most rigorous means of constraint, deprivation of freedom, and in certain circumstances, castration. So those who defend Nietzsche, I think, would find it hard to claim that he does not provide a strong philosophical underpinning for what will turn out to be the only widespread attempt to implement these values that existed in the Western world, and that is in Germany during the 1930s, which we will look at in a little more detail. And again, lest we become complacent or feel superior and condescending in remembering that it was under National Socialism in Germany that these eugenic ideas were implemented in a horrific sort of way, and as we'll see, that later the whole apparatus of eugenic sterilization was applied to genocide as well. Unless we become complacent, it's important to remember in number 1.5, and we'll look at the article in a little more detail from which this section is excerpted, that sterilization laws in the United States were very, very widespread, and in the United States a pattern of or a notion of eugenics was taken for granted really across society, from presidents to members of the Supreme Court and to members of legislatures in many, many states. As we've noted, and we'll just look at this briefly because we'll come back to this a little later, by 1926, 23 states had enacted sterilization laws, and in many cases, this was not simply voluntary sterilization, but it became compulsory. And if you look carefully at who it was that was being sterilized, it was a larger proportion of poor and minority residents. In particular, this has been documented in Virginia and California, where individuals were either black as in Virginia, or who were members of non-white or foreign-born groups in California. So the frightening statistics are that in the United States, the eugenics mentality resulted in a very large number of forcible sterilizations, and we need to remind ourselves that this was in an era where there was no absolutely consistent definition of or diagnosis of mental disease. And so if one looks back at the records, the criteria according to which these sterilizations were performed are really quite appalling, and in some cases had very little to do with people's mental illness. We'll come back to this when we look more closely at individuals who attempted to justify this kind of approach after we've had an opportunity to look at Pius XI's specific condemnation of eugenics.